good. Okay, now we have to find the switch. Okay, well, I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to give this talk. I'm going to talk today about some work that I've done recently over the last 6 months or so with David Berenstein and Vishnu Jajela, who's in the audience here somewhere. And the general subject is to think about the physics of D-brains on orbifolds. And one of the primary motivations for us was to find a simple model that gave rise to something that was very close to the standard model. So let's begin by thinking a little bit about traditional string model building. And let me characterize that model building by two things. First of all, one normally thought of the string scale as being roughly the same as the Planck scale, or very close to it, assuming the string was weakly coupled and all of that. And the second thing that traditional string model building was characterized as not much success in terms of really understanding where the standard model is going to come from, or choosing a particular vacuum state. Maybe that's a little bit pessimistic. There certainly are ways to generate the standard model from traditional model building, but nothing terribly compelling. So the idea here is that given recent new ideas about the physics of compactifications and the size of the string scale, we thought it would be interesting to explore this sort of new paradigm where the scales involved are quite different. So the question is, are there consistent examples that come from string theory which give rise to the standard model? Not in the traditional string model building sense, but in the sense, as I'll describe a little bit more detail in a moment, where we have a low string scale compared to the Planck scale. Many of these ideas that have come about, you know, through Randall Sundrum and ideas like that, or large extra dimensions, and many of those ideas, I think most string theorists would claim, really only have a chance of making sense within the context of string theory. So when phenomenologists talk about theories on a brain, we should really think about that brain as being a D-brain in string theory. So the question is can you really do this? Can you find such consistent models? So let me give you a few warnings, first of all, about things I'm not going to address. I'm not going to even think about or certainly solve any possible stability problems that often arise in discussions of large extra dimensions or Randall Sundrum or whatever. I'm not going to talk about the cosmological constant problem, and I'm going to refuse to talk about details of cosmology in these scenarios. That's something that we haven't really thought about, but is perhaps an interesting topic. On the other hand, so those are my warnings, but on the other hand, I'll give you a model. Again, it's a consistent string model, which is fairly compelling. It gives rise to physics, which is very close to that of the standard model. And the really exciting thing for me is that as you work out the phenomenology of this model, you find that, in fact, it really works very well. And if it's ruled out by experiments, it's only through the gory details, only through precision experiments, in fact. So I'll show you some of those details later on. Okay. So let's think about building the standard model from string theory. And let me just point out that there's one challenge that we confront immediately, and that is that the standard model is a chiral gauge theory. And getting chiral gauge theories is not always trivial in string theory. Certainly various ways known to do this. Several that I'd like to point out, one that I'll focus on and one that should be mentioned, is the idea of using intersecting brains. This was noticed in a paper with Ricuz and Douglas 5 or 6 years ago, that if you took intersecting brain solutions and looked at the gauge theories you get on the intersection that, depending on the details, those theories could be chiral. And there are attempts along these lines using intersecting brains by a number of groups, which I just mentioned I won't review here. The alternative that I'd like to explore today is by not using that sort of scenario, but by just thinking about orbifolds and thinking about having D brains at orbifolds. Now, in order to get something like the standard model, I'm not going to be able to just work with the garden variety abelian orbifold. I'm going to have to do something much, much more complex. But it turns out that there is at least one example, one that I'll talk about today, which works very well. And there may be other ways to get chirality, to get appropriate gauge theories, but I won't say anything further about that. Okay, so let me be precise about what I have in mind here for this brain world. So I'm just talking about 10-dimensional superstring theory with some 6-dimensional space, which I'll refer to as X. Sometimes I guess I'm going to refer to it as M. Sorry about that. But on this transparency, I'll call it X. And I'm going to assume very little about what that space is, okay, other than it's 6-dimensional. And the only thing that as we go through the talk, we'll pull out a few features that we need to know about this space. But for now, let me just say that there's a special point in this space. It's an orbifold singularity. And there are D3 brains trapped at that point. Okay, so this is a point in this 6-dimensional space, and so that corresponds to a 3-brain because there are 3 plus 1 additional dimensions. So we're going to live on that brain, and the standard model, all the physics of the standard model will be confined to that brain in the usual way. And as I said, I don't need to know much about this 6-dimensional space, but there's a few features that I do need. First of all, whatever that space is, I'm going to require that it's such that I end up with a low string scale, say around 10 TeV. And as we'll see, I don't put that in by hand, but to get the phenomenology correct, in fact, to get lepton masses to come out at reasonable levels, we have to have this. So in fact, the model that I'll describe, if I was in a traditional string compactification, it would be just wildly wrong. Well, the gauge symmetries would be correct, but the particle spectrum would be completely wrong. So this is required by phenomenology, as I'll show you. The other assumption I'm going to make is that supersymmetry is broken in some way off of this brain, and I'm not going to specify how that breaking occurs. It doesn't really matter to us. All I'm going to require is that Suzy breaking gets communicated to the physics on the brain in a generic way. So I'm going to allow, in fact, I'm going to want to have arbitrary higher dimensional operators from the supersymmetry breaking, and I'm just going to assume that they're there. Anything allowed by gauge invariance is there with a coefficient which is more or less of order 1.
But not broken by the orbifold.
Right, the orbifold will break down to n equals 1. Supersymmetry in 4 dimensions. So the supersymmetry I'm talking about is that. So there's some additional Suzy breaking going on. Okay, so that's some features of the space X. What are the important features of this special place? Well, first of all, as I said, there's a D brain there. It's a local orbifold singularity, and we're going to choose that thing such that we get the right theory out. Well, I should say, better to say that there is a choice where we get a reasonable theory to come out. The one thing I should mention is that you should not think about this 6-dimensional space as a global orbifold. Okay, you should not think about this necessarily as some 6-dimensional space orbifolded. Rather, it's just some more generic space where I have an orbifold, a local orbifold singularity. So you might, if you like, you might think about this as a collabiao where you've got some local orbifold singularity from some blowdown or something. Okay, so hopefully by now you've got the point that the purpose of this talk is to talk about a particular model which gives rise to the standard model. But I thought I would sidetrack a little bit to show you some details of how you can build models from complicated orbifolds. And so what I'm going to have in mind here is where we have non-abelian orbifolds, perhaps with discrete torsion. And so I just want to go through some of the details and some of the tricks that we've developed to analyze such models. Okay, so let me remind you how this works in general. If you have a D-brain at an orbifold singularity, well, you can ask what is the gauge theory on the D-brain. And the details of that gauge theory and its spectrum is, in fact, just determined by group theory, the group associated with the orbifold. And that comes about, well, it comes about in the following way. If you think about having open string states which attach to the D-brain, there are modes there which correspond to the position of the brain within this six-dimensional space. And one can think about that position sort of mathematically in terms of an irreducible representation of the algebra which is associated with the six-dimensional space. Okay, so the general point is that if you want to find out about D-brain configurations, then what you do is you construct an appropriate algebra and do the representation theory of that algebra. Okay, here's a trivial example. Suppose I'm not talking about an orbifold, I'm just talking about six-dimensional space or three-dimensional complex space. The algebra in question in that case is just the abelian algebra of three objects, the three complex coordinates in this space. And you can look for representations of that algebra. And because it's abelian, the representation theory is trivial. All you have is one-dimensional representations. X, Y, and Z are proportional to the identity. And so there are three parameters, which I called alpha, beta, gamma here, which label distinct representations. So any one of these representations is just a triple, so it corresponds to a point in C3. So this is kind of trivial, but what this means is that if I try to put a point-like brain in six dimensions, if it's just flat space, then that brain can be anywhere. Okay, and any point then corresponds to an irreducible representation. So as I said, that's a trivial example, but in order to understand orbifolds, you can follow the same logic. And in the case of an orbifold, what you do is you choose an appropriate algebra here. So if I'm talking about a global orbifold, Cn mod g, or C3 mod g, I should say, then the algebra that one should look at, the representation theory that I should do, is referred to as a cross-product algebra. It's the algebra of the three coordinates of C3 together with the group elements of the group that I'm modding by, with some relations between those elements. So here's a simple example of that. If we take probably the simplest possible example of an orbifold, C2 mod Z2. Now I have two-dimensional complex space, so I'd take the cross product of the abelian algebra of two generators, X and Y, coordinates in the two-plane, with the Z2. And this algebra, this cross-product algebra, is just generated by X, Y, and something which I'll call sigma, which is a generator of Z2. And these guys satisfy some relations. First of all, X and Y commute. And X and sigma and Y and sigma satisfy an algebraic relation, which just comes from the Z2 action on the coordinates. And sigma should square to 1, just because this is a Z2. So you can think about this, if you like, as a non-commutative algebra. It's quite useful to think that way. In the present context, what we want to do is we want to understand the representation theory of this algebra. So you can go ahead and do that. At a generic point, you find that there are two-dimensional representations, which look like this, for arbitrary alpha and beta complex. These sigmas here are the Pauli matrices. And what these representations correspond to is the so-called bulk brain at the point alpha comma beta in the two-plane. And that's the representation theory almost everywhere, except at the orbifold singularity, which occurs at the origin. And at that point, this two-dimensional representations actually becomes reducible. This is irreducible everywhere else, but at this point it becomes reducible into two one-dimensional representations. And those one-dimensional representations correspond to fractional brains, which are confined at the orbifold singularity. So this is a general process that one can go through. If you choose a different orbifold, you just have to repeat the analysis. Let me just draw a picture of what I just said. Again, you can sort of think about this space. So again, I'm talking about C2 mod Z2. You can sort of think about the bulk of the space. This is meant to imply the bulk of the space, and there is this two-dimensional brain that exists out there. As I go to the singularity, it splits into those two things split into two physical brains. The other thing that I should mention is that the representation theory corresponds to the gauge groups that one gets in the gauge theory. And the spectrum, the matter fields in which representations they fall in, can also be worked out from details of the representation theory. So what we normally do is we organize all of this mess in terms of a quiver diagram, which is just a picture that allows us to draw all of the gauge groups and matter fields. So as an example, in the case of C2 mod Z2, we draw a node in the quiver diagram this is what it is at the singularity. We draw a node in the diagram for each of the one-dimensional representations, and we draw lines in the quiver which represent matter fields. And if such a line connects one node to another, it means that it's charged under both of those gauge groups. Okay, so in that context, the gauge group is U1 times U1, and there are fields which are charged under both. More generally, so there we just had one-dimensional representations. More generally, we find n-dimensional representations, and when I draw a quiver, there's a rank associated with each node, which is just the dimension of the corresponding representation. And if just the single one-dimensional representation corresponds to U1, then an n-dimensional representation would give a UN gauge group. Okay. Okay, well, that wasn't so bad in the case of an abelian group, the one that I just considered. But suppose we consider the more general problem of d-brains at orbifold singularities. There's several choices that we can make. First of all, we can choose a different orbifold group. And for example, in the context that I've set up here, if I want to end up with an n equals 1 supersymmetric gauge theory, then I should choose that group G to be a subgroup of SU3, the unitary group in three dimensions. And beyond that, there's another choice that one can make, which is perhaps not so well known, but there's a choice of discrete torsion. And discrete torsion is classified by a second cohomology group of the orbifold group into U1. And, well, so given such a group, I have to figure out what discrete torsion is allowed. What this corresponds to is a certain choice of phases that I can stick in when I do the orbifold. I'll say more about that in a second. Okay, so we have those choices to make, and as I said, all of the details of the gauge theory that I get are determined by representation theory of this group, of the orbifold group G. And in fact, in the case where I have non-trivial discrete torsion, it turns out to be projective representation theory instead of just the ordinary sort. Well, this can be rather difficult, because if I choose some random non-abelian group, just classifying all the representations, although straightforward can be tedious. And so we've developed a little bit of technology which allows us to write these theories down relatively quickly. And so what's the idea? Well, we want to end up with a representation theory of this perhaps complicated group G. And it turns out that such representation theory can be organized in terms of representation of theory of a normal subgroup of G. So let me call that N. And in such a case, then, these groups N and G fit into an exact sequence where the last element here is G mod N. So in that case, in fact, it turns out that one can build the orbifold that I want in terms of a two-step process or a multi-step process where I first construct the orbifold by the normal subgroup N, and then I mod further by the quotient G mod N. So this, if you like, this is an orbifold of an orbifold. And the utility of this is that this can be much simpler. Okay, for example, in fact, this will be the case in the examples that I show you today. For example, even if G is non-abelian, it can be the case that both N and G mod N are abelian. And so it can be very simple to understand what these what the steps are in this process.
Is G a continuous group?
G is a discrete group, discrete subgroup.
N
is a subgroup of that discrete group, so it's discrete as well. Yeah, I should have said that, sorry. Another simplifying feature that can happen is that if the discrete torsion of the subgroup N is trivial, then the discrete torsion of G, if it exists, is in fact encoded in possible different ways of doing this second orbifold. So there are additional choices one can make in doing that second orbifold, and that corresponds to different choices of discrete torsion. Yes, it is. What's the question?
It's not a group.
Well, it can be a group. Yes, in general, it's some set of elements which act on N. Right. So perhaps I'm misspeaking. In the example that I'll show you, in fact, it is a group, but
it needs.
Actually. Yeah, I guess that's right. That's why I'm calling it a group. Thank you. Yeah, it actually is a group. Sorry, one forgets these things. Okay. So, so the idea then is that I'm going to build the quiver, which tells me all the information about the gauge theory for C3 mod G by first constructing the quiver of C3 mod N, and then I'll have to figure out how G mod N acts on this quiver. And there's some set of rules that have been devised to tell you how to do this. I'm not going to bore you with the details, but I'll show you how it works in a simple example. Okay, so indeed, consider a simple example, just C3 mod Z3 times Z3. This is an abelian example, and certainly we understand what this orbifold is, so I'm just doing this as an example. We're not learning anything really new. So in this case, G is Z3 times Z3. N is going to be Z3, and G mod N is Z3. So everything is 3. And in this case, Z3 by itself doesn't have discrete torsion. Z3 times Z3, though, does have Z3 discrete torsion. Okay. Well, since there's no torsion in N, if I want to construct C3 mod N, there's only one choice. There's only one quiver that I can get, which is the which is just three nodes organized in a circle, and matter fields which connect adjacent nodes. Now, so that's C3 mod Z3. What I want to end up with is C3 mod Z3 times Z3. So the rule was that I have to figure out how G mod N acts on this quiver. Well, I can do that by remembering that each of these nodes corresponds to a representation, and so I just have to figure out how G mod n acts on each of those representations. And in fact, there's a choice of how that action comes about. There's essentially two possibilities. There's actually three, but two of them are sort of complex conjugates of one another. The simplest thing to do is to just say that G mod n doesn't do anything. It just acts trivially on each of these nodes. So if you like, they're in one-dimensional representations of G mod n. And in that case, what happens is that each of those nodes splits into three, where three is the three of this Z3. One ends up with a quiver which has nine nodes. And I've drawn in the arrows here corresponding to matter fields. I'm not going to tell you how that works, but again, there's some representation theory that determines what those are. So that's one possible answer for the Z3 times Z3 orbifold fold. There's one other possibility, which is the case where we have discrete torsion in the orbifold. In that case, G mod n acts on these three nodes by permuting them around. And the rule is that when that happens, so I get a three-dimensional orbit of G mod n on the original quiver. When that happens, the three nodes coalesce into one representation, one node of the full orbifold, but it has rank 3. Okay, so here's the orbifold that we're interested in phenomenologically. It's referred to as delta 27. It's one of a series of discrete non-abelian subgroups of SU3, often referred to as delta 3n squared. And these groups fit into an exact sequence of this type. Okay, so here my n is going to be zn times zn, and in fact I'm going to take n equals 3 for delta 27. So this is going to be, n is going to be z3 times z3, delta 27, and g mod n is a z3 again. Okay, so if you like, one can, as I've just been discussing, one can construct this non-abelian orbifold in two steps. First do this, and then do the z3 orbifold of that. Well, for this particular group, what I really need to tell you is how this Z3 acts on everything. This Zn times Zn is just just the usual Zn times Zn orbifold on C3. One of the generators acts on X and Y. The second generator acts on Y and Z. And omega here is going to be a third root of unity. Wherever you see omega, it's always a third root of unity. And E3, the generator, there's a third generator, which is the generator of this Z3, and what it does on X, Y, Z, the coordinates of C3, is permute them. Okay, well, let me just cut to the chase. If you do the representation theory for this group, either by doing it in steps like this or by doing it just brute force, by looking for representations, what you find is that there are two three-dimensional representations and nine one-dimensional representations, and these are all distinct. I'm wondering if I have time to do this, but okay, let's do it the second way. Let me just show you how this works by doing it in steps. First of all, what we should do is we should do the Z3 times Z3 orbifold. So the cross product involves X, Y, Z and the two generators of Z3 times Z3. You can write down algebraic relations satisfied by these objects. If you like, you do the representation theory, you end up with the nine-node quiver that we just talked about. Okay, it's the same thing. It's the one without discrete torsion. Okay, and if you like, you can associate those nine representations with just the various possible phases associated with E1 and E2. Okay, then what I want to do is the Z3 orbifold of that. So I want to introduce E3, the generator of the Z3. And what we have to do then is consider the action of this Z3 on this quiver, or equivalently, the action of E3 on these representations. And so one can do that. One can just pretty simply read off what that is. And what you find is that, this is actually the wrong diagram, but it's almost right. It's got the right, the counting is right, the details are slightly wrong. What you find is that three of these representations are acted trivially upon by the Z3. Say this one, this one, and this one. And then there are two three-dimensional orbits under the action of G mod n. The three-dimensional orbits both become three-dimensional representations of delta 27, and each of these three one-dimensional orbits here become a set of three one-dimensional orbits, one-dimensional representations of the full orbifold. So what we end up with then, as I said before, are two three-dimensional representations, and 3 times 3 are 9 one-dimensional representations. Should also worry about the matter fields, the lines in the quiver, and I'm not going to say anything about this really, other than to note that it can be worked out. It's just representation theory. It can be worked out which representations you get. And for this trick of using this orbifold of orbifold, there's an additional set of rules that you can use to generate the lines of the new quiver from the old one. Okay, so for delta 27, here's the quiver that you end up with. This is actually two copies of the same quiver. Let me look at the one on the right. First of all, it's a quiver with the two three-dimensional representations and 9 one-dimensional representations, and the lines here correspond to chiral n equals 1 superfields. For example, one of these lines here is a fundamental of that SU3 and an anti-fundamental of that SU3. This line here means that it's, what did I say, a fundamental of this SU3 and charge, say, plus 1 with respect to that particular U1 associated with that node. Another way to draw this is just in a simpler form like this. The only reason I do that is so that I can conveniently label the fields that are present. And so try to keep that in your head. There are three fields here, which I'll refer to as Q for the moment. There are 9 fields actually here, each of which are charged under a different U1, a different one of these U1s, which I'll call Q bar. And there are 9 fields here, which I'll refer to as L. Okay, so this is going to be, in fact, this is going to give rise to the standard model after a few more steps. Let me just notice that I'm going to identify these three lines here with the left-handed quarks of the standard model, okay, or the superfields associated with those quarks for the time being. And they have the right representation structure as long as I associate the color SU3 with this group, and weak SU2 is going to sit inside here. Notice one thing is that these are chiral automatically by construction, and there are 3 of these fields, so I'm going to end up with a 3-generation standard model, and I don't have any way of changing that. This just comes out with 3 generations. I'd like to say it just is. it's actually pretty generic in n equals 1 orbifolds. Even if you look at Zm times Zn, just the abelian orbifold, that's chiral by itself. So in fact, once one starts looking at orbifolds, it's not such a surprise to find chiral models. What it is a surprise is to find the right chiral model. So let me put that up. Let me not put that up there.
You say you get 3 generations, you can't change that, but if you set n equals 3, isn't that 1?
Well, yeah, you could say I've chosen delta 27. I could have chosen delta 3 n squared, and n equals 4 is 4 generations. In fact, it doesn't work that way. It's not. If I go to delta, what's 3 times 4 times 4? Whatever that is, 48. then it, you know, it's not as simple as, say, replace this 3 by a 4 or anything like that, such that you would get 4 generations. In fact, you can work out what that quiver is, and it's just a big, it's a big mess. This is a special model, and it's just special.
What is the brain configuration behind this goose box?
What is the brain configuration? Okay, so the idea is that I will, if I go back to one of the first transparencies, what I'll have is a six-dimensional space, and this, right, so I had this picture, this delta 27 singularity that I'm talking about, I'm constructing it as if the space was a global orbifold by delta 27. More generally, you can just think about sort of inserting that locally into a more general space. And so we're going to have, that's the idea, is that we have a local delta 27 singularity sitting within this space, and there are d-brains, there are fractional d-brains at that point. Does that not work? It's not a big deal. But never mind.
I can't.
It's not plugged in, you're right. Okay, so let me review what we had here. There's the quiver again, drawn in that simple way. By construction, it has n equals 1 supersymmetry because delta 27 is a discrete subgroup of SU3 and not SU2. The gauge group that I get is U3 times U3 times U1 to the ninth, except that there's an overall U1 that gets frozen out and it's not there. So we end up with, if you like, SU3 times SU3 with 10 U1s. And it's chiral, as I mentioned. The fields, the superfields that we have so far are these Qs. They're fundamental with respect to one of the SU3s, anti-fundamental with respect to the other, and not charged with respect to these U1s. There are some 9 fields that I refer to as L, which are charged under that SU3, but not that one. And Q bar is the opposite. It's charged under the first SU3, but not the second. Furthermore, there's a tree level superpotential that you find, which just couples these three fields together in an arbitrary way up to the gauge symmetries of the theory, so QL, Q bar. And there are some coefficients which one could compute at tree level in string theory, but we'll just assume that they're order 1. I don't have any reason to believe that they have some special sizes. Okay, so remember we have these two SU3s. We have the fields Q, which are beginning to look like they're left-handed quarks. And so what I'm going to do is associate SU3 color with this one, and I'm going to associate SU2 weak with this one. And I need to show you how I break this SU3 down to SU2 weak times some U1s. In fact, that turns out to be an easy thing to do. So this is just what I said before. It turns out there's a variety of ways that one can arrange for this breaking. There are FI terms for all of the various U1s, which I can turn on in order to induce this breaking, for example. And what this really corresponds to is that if I want to do this breaking, I'm not going to be sitting exactly at the orbifold point in moduli space, but I'm going to move in the moduli space a little bit. As I do that, I can do that in such a way that that symmetry gets Higgs down to SU2. Okay, so let me just assume that happens. That's a point in moduli space where that happens. And I'm going to relabel the fields that I had, Q, Q bar, and L, And once you start doing that, you notice that something very nice happens. Let me overlay the representations here. There we go. So this is SU3 color times SU2 weak. I'm not going to bother with the U1s for the moment. The fields in red are fields which occur in the standard model, and the fields in blue are some extra fields, which in a moment will actually go away for the most part. So at least at this level, this now looks, once I break the SU3 down to SU2, this looks a lot like the supersymmetric standard model. There's several things to notice. One is that I have three generations of right-handed neutrinos, which is actually a good thing these days. And in fact, I don't have just one pair of Higgs doublets, but I have one for each generation. So I have six Higgs doublets total.
Can you have a massive neutrino?
I'll show you that, yes. You do have massive neutrinos. Of course you have massive neutrinos. Well, it's not so easy, but we'll see. Okay, so the feature so far is that, let me just reiterate, I've got three generations of quarks and leptons. I've got right-handed neutrinos, which Gordner is interested in. I've got a pair of Higgses for each generation. And I should have mentioned on the last transparency, but we're going to think about that SU3 to SU2 weak breaking as going through VEVs of the field G. And it turns out, so let me show you the fields again. There's this field G, which is the SU3 partner of what's going to become left-handed lepton doublets. I'm going to give VEVs to these Gs, but I'm also going to give VEVs to the scalar component of the neutrino, the right-handed neutrino. And that's okay as far as the standard model is concerned, because that right-handed neutrino is, of course, neutral with respect to the standard model. You could try to get by just giving VEVs to the Gs, but it turns out that you, for phenomenological reasons, and maybe for naturality or something, you want to give VEVs to the nu bars as well. Okay, so new notation then, we just have to write down the tree-level superpotential, and what we find, remember we had Q, Q bar, L, if we now write that out in terms of these new names for the fields, we find that there are Yukawa couplings for each of the quarks, U bar and D bar. They each have their own Higgses, and the coefficients here are just generic, and there's lots of room for CKM phases and all of that structure. And there's a bunch more terms, but one that we need to focus on is that we also end up with a G, Q, Q bar term. Remember, those were the three fields that I wrote in blue over here that were things that I didn't like. They're not in the standard model. But when I turn on a VEV for G, this just means that Q and Q bar now get a mass. They're vector-like. They're three vector-like quarks, and they get a mass of order the VEV of this G field. Okay, so the matter's looking good. Maybe the gauge group isn't looking so good. Remember, I had these more or less 10 U1s hanging around. So we need to talk about the gauge symmetry a little further. There's two effects here. One is that I've just broken SU3 down to SU2. Well, I should also pay attention to the U1 charges of these fields that I'm giving VEVs to. So that breaking also breaks a bunch of the U1s. But also, if you look at the anomalies, the gauge anomalies of these various U1s, there are mixed anomalies present, and that's okay. This is string theory, so Green-Schwarz takes over. And at the end of the day, what the bottom line is that there are additional U1s that are broken through Green-Schwarzing. The residual gauge group, then, is SU3 color times SU2 weak times U1 hypercharge. Good so far, but there are two extra U1s. And as we've discussed, the matter fields look very good, apart from the extra Higgses that are present. So this is going to be a problem. You certainly have to worry about that phenomenologically, because there will be particles associated with that, hope go away in some way. Okay, well, so problem so far. Remember that I wrote out for you what the superpotential of this theory was, and I noted that there were quark-Yukawa couplings. But you might have noticed that there are no lepton-Yukawa couplings present. And so, at least at that level, it would appear that leptons are all massless, and there's not much you could do about that experimentally. You'd be killed if that was really the case. So what I need to show you is how you generate lepton masses and mixings. They don't come about at tree level, at a level of a tree level superpotential. Another problem is that, at least as far as I've gone in the discussion, supersymmetry is unbroken. I'd like to get rid of that. And, well, there are some extra U1s, as I noticed. In fact, this problem will be solved by solving this problem, as we'll see. So it's, in fact, there's kind of a nice structure here, which is unusual. This is, you can't really think about this model as the minimal supersymmetric standard model. There are, and that's because, precisely because of this reason. There's no lepton-Yukawas present, but important details of the mass spectrum of the theory come about only through supersymmetry breaking. And this is possible because of because I'm going to take the string scale to be low. Okay, so how do I do supersymmetry breaking? Well, as I said on the first transparency, I don't care how I do supersymmetry breaking. I'm just going to assume that it is broken in some way by some dynamics off of the brain in the six-dimensional space. I can put anything out there I like without affecting the physics that I've talked about on this three brain. And so let's just imagine that that is there. All I'm going to do is I'm going to assume that that Susie breaking is communicated to the physics on the brain through higher dimensional operators. So for example, you can write down a Kähler potential with arbitrary operators here suppressed by powers of the string scale. And as far as the supersymmetry breaking is concerned, I'm going to parameterize the supersymmetry breaking by spurion couplings. So there's going to be fictitious fields there that have F terms that give rise to supersymmetry breaking effects. But other than, well, it's important to realize I'm not making any assumptions, at least to begin with, about the form of these things. I'm just going to write down anything allowed by the gauge symmetries and hope that the physics turns out reasonably that way. Okay, and another thing that I should mention, very important and a very nice feature of this model, is that the fact that I didn't generate lepton-Yukawa couplings at tree level is actually a nice feature, because in the real world, leptons are lighter than quarks. The lepton-Yukawas are going to be generated in a transparency or two by Susie breaking effects, and so we get a natural, and those are suppressed compared to the tree level quark-Yukawa coupling, so we get a nice hierarchy of masses in that way. Okay, so let me just briefly say something about supersymmetry breaking. As I said, I'm going to parameterize the effects of supersymmetry breaking on the brain through spurions, which will have an F-term VEV, and we can write Kähler potential couplings that couple these spurions in a generic way to standard model fields. So here's an example of a term that you might write down. Phi here could be any standard model field. And what will happen, it's a trivial argument to see that if you it's a trivial argument to see that you generate F terms for these standard model fields, which I'll call F sub I, as soon as these guys, as soon as these F terms are present. And so the F term of a standard model field is proportional to the supersymmetry scale times the VEV of that same field. Okay, so lepton masses. I noted that they're not present in the superpotential. In fact, they're forbidden by gauge symmetry, the gauge symmetries that I started out with. However, they can be generated through supersymmetry breaking by higher dimensional operators, not operators that involve spurions, but operators that just involve standard model superfields. So here's here's the example which is appropriate for lepton, for generating lepton masses. So remember this L, there were 9 of these L's, so you can write out various possibilities in this new notation. One of them might be of this form, and if you give an F term to G, you can then this will then generate fermion mass terms when the Higgs scalar gets a VeV. Okay, so through effects like this, then you can get masses for charged leptons. They're proportional to the Susie breaking scale, proportional to these G VeVs. They're suppressed by powers of M string because they come from these higher dimensional operators. Those are the charged leptons. At the same time, you get Dirac masses and Majorana masses for neutrinos. Those are, and they're different. They come about through similar operators, but the details are slightly different. You can see here, for example, that in order to get Majorana masses for the neutrinos, you have to give sneutrino VeVs here. So that was one reason why we chose to give those VeVs when we broke SU3 to SU2. And if you look at the details, there's at least a mild seesaw mechanism that occurs here. And remember, that's important for making, it's an important aspect of the, for the masses of neutrinos. You end up with some light neutrinos that way, as well as some relatively heavy ones.
Okay. Is this kind of the interaction from naturally arising from the fibers?
This is just a higher dimensional operator. It's allowed by the. Yeah, you could go out and do string perturbation theory, I suppose, and find these operators. But they're higher dimensional operators. You don't often worry about them, but they're there. So here's a example of the scales that we might have in mind in this theory. These are chosen such that the lepton masses that I just wrote down for you are somewhat reasonable in size. If we take the string scale to be about 10 TeV, and we take these G and nu bar VeVs to be around a TeV, and we take the Susie scale to be around 3 TeV, then things work out relatively nicely. At least heuristically, they're in a reasonable range. As I said, the fact that the string scale is low in this scenario is just imagining that that's guaranteed by the details of the space, the six-dimensional space. Okay, so just to finish up then, let me look at a little bit of the phenomenology of these models. I'm just going to do it heuristically. In fact, the gory details haven't been worked out completely yet. But certainly we're doing pretty well. We've got a decent gauge symmetry and a very decent set of matter fields, of light matter fields. And so there's a number of things that we might like to look at. Proton decay, we might worry about these extra U1 symmetries that we have. Flavor-changing neutral currents are always a worry in extensions of the standard model. We might worry about details of the mass spectrum. I told you that we can generate lepton, charged lepton, and neutrino masses, but is it really correct, or do we have to bend over backwards to get the masses right, or what exactly is the story? So you can worry about all of those things. Proton decay, in fact, has a very nice solution in this model. This is something that we noted in this model. It's a similar mechanism has been noticed in these intersecting brain solutions as well. And, well, the answer is that there just are no perturbative baryon-violating processes. And the reason is very simple. That is, if you look at the charges of the fields that we have, the U1 baryon symmetry is, in fact, a gauge symmetry. It's the U1 associated with this upper U3 node here. Okay, so it's really U3, it's SU3 times U1. The U1 there is nothing but baryon number. So at least perturbatively, there are no baryon number violating processes, and protons are happy. Quickly, what about the extra U1s? Remember I said the gauge group was the standard model times U1 squared. And, well, you have to worry about what are the effects of those extra U1s. First of all, you could worry about, in collider experiments, you could worry about directly producing these Z prime bosons associated with those U1s. You could also worry about the effects of those new particles in precision measurements that people, experimentalists, do. And this has to be looked at in a lot more detail. There's a couple of things that are going in the right direction here. First of all, these extra U1s, if you work out the charges of the fields, they actually only couple to, well, the one that's relevant is the right-handed up quarks. And so that actually, in the way people usually quote bounds on extra Z primes, assumes couplings of a certain sort, and the fact that we have non-generic couplings like this helps quite a bit. The second thing to note is that the couplings, the gauge couplings of these U1s, are actually moduli. They're free parameters, and so we can move around in the moduli space a little bit if needed by this physics. Heuristically, the answer seems to be that this is okay, although, as I said, it needs to be worked out carefully. Flavor-changing neutral currents. So this has to do with the details. Well, you can, in a supersymmetric model, you can associate this with the form of the Skork mass matrix, say, and whether or no, well, the detailed form of that Skork mass matrix will lead to, if there are off-diagonal terms of certain size, that will lead to flavor-changing physics. And so you can within this model, if you allow, as we've been doing, generic Kähler potential couplings, you can search through all of that and look for possible effects that would lead to flavor-changing neutral currents. And it appears, again, at the heuristic level, that there certainly are flavor-changing neutral currents present in the model, assuming that these coefficients are of order 1. But there's a little bit of a suppression, and it's possible that these things are, in fact, consistent with present-day experiments. But again, this is something that the details, the devil might be in the details. Okay, a couple of other issues that are being addressed. Details of the mass spectrum, I referred to them earlier. You can worry, are the neutrino masses that I've generated, do I really get them to be light enough? Don't know. And also, it turns out there's an issue. There's some other particles that come about because the theory was once supersymmetric. Fermions, Chargino fermions. And one worries whether these are heavy enough, they're all heavy enough to be consistent with present-day experiments. Again, I don't yet know the answer to those questions. Let me just conclude with, recapping what we've done. We were interested in exploring this new way of doing string model building associated with having small string scales. And what we found here is an example of a consistent string model, which is a relatively simple theory. It's based on an orbifold, a local orbifold singularity, which was deformed a little bit. We had to move a little bit on moduli space in order to, in order for various features to come out. But it's a very nice model. It's a long list of things correct. And it's also important to realize that, you know, phenomenologists or Randall Sundramists, when they talk about those theories, they're often concerned, for good reason, about the stability of the system that they have in mind. There might be a radion instability or something like that. This is, you know, an example of a generic problem in string theory. And in this context, though, any instability in the model, as far as I know, really has to do with the space X itself, and it doesn't have anything to do with the construction of the standard model. Okay, so the issue of stability or instability has to do with this six-dimensional space, and is sort of not so the physics of the standard model is not so sensitive to that. So we're assuming that the thing exists, but once we do that, we're okay. There are lots of examples in string theory where you have to make assumptions akin to that and go from there. Several interesting features. It requires, as I've emphasized, a low string scale. Supersymmetry breaking leads directly to interesting aspects of the spectrum and phenomenology. That's kind of an interesting new feature. And furthermore, if the model is ruled out, it's only ruled out by precision experiments, which is a pretty exciting thing for string theorists, because we're not used to thinking about string theory as a testable theory. So let me finish there. Thanks. Gordon.
Just two naive questions. What about coupling to bulk gravity, and what about gravity on the brain? Coupling to bulk gravity suppressed somehow, and is gravity on the brain come back by some natural means?
Remember that transparency I had, that warning? I'm not going to talk about these. the party line is that I will defer all such questions to Randall Sundrum, and who will tell me what I should, which space I should choose, in order that that works out. Do you have a specific problem in mind, or?
I just thought that the precision experiments looking for gravitons leaking into the higher dimensional space might rule out your model before precision particles.
If you want, okay, so I think what you're saying then is that any brain world is ruled out. And if that's the case, then I surrender. Okay. There's nothing specific to this model, right? I mean, it's the whole scenario you're worried about, and perhaps.
Somewhat related question. What is the number of brains?
The number of brains?
Yeah, yeah. You just consider just one brain, like the singularity?
There's a three brain at the singularity. But what I'm, remember, at the singularity there are all of these different fractional brains, and I'm assuming that there's one of each there.
There might be some gravitational interaction being there.
Well, they're all at the same. They're all at the same point. They're all at the orbifold singularity. They're not separated in any way, at least at the, you know, classical approximation. You know, such interactions are governed by string theory, so is there another question? How does it arise? Well, remember when we started out, there were 10 U1s, and there were several types of breakings that went on with the U1s, both Green-Schwarz and through Higgsing. We ended up with 3 U1s, and your question really is one of those U1s something which I can identify with hypercharge, or is hypercharge non-anomalous? And the answer to all those questions is yes. It's just hypercharge is just a particular linear combination of the unbroken non-anomalous U1s.
So hypercharge come out, right?
Yes. Yes.
again from your list of warnings. Since you put the engagement, could you say anything interesting about their
asymmetry? This is exactly why I said I wasn't going to talk about cosmology. I think that's a great question, and it's something that occurred to me. But in order to answer questions like that, you have to have some cosmology in mind. These old ideas about generating baryon asymmetry at the electroweak scale could presumably still fly, at least to the extent that they ever flew. But you know, other than that, I don't have any great ideas. Before thinking about some detailed question like that, I would like to have an idea of what the cosmology might be like of such a model, and that's something I just haven't thought about. Maybe you have. I don't know. Maybe somebody has. I don't know. Back there.
Might there be other discrete subgroups of FP3 that would give something like a standard model? Are they all known?
Yeah, they're more or less classified. The answer is not to my knowledge. You can always, what you can always do is, and this is often what's done in traditional model building in string theory, is that you can find some model that has sort of a little corner of the theory, which is the standard model, and then there's lots of other stuff that you hope goes away in some way. And certainly there are lots of examples of orbifolds like that. From that point of view, the only thing that's nice about this particular model is that it's very conservative. It doesn't have that extra junk present. It doesn't have extra junk that it couples to the gauge symmetries.
Do you get CP violation in the strong and the weak sector?
Yes. Well, it's actually something I haven't thought about in detail. Of course, you know, it's perfectly consistent with the standard model symmetries to have CP violation, and so there's no reason to expect it not to be present. But I haven't thought out, you know, how that comes about from string theory. But, I'm making the assumption that it's there, certainly, that it can be there. Okay.
Well, no other questions. Thank you, our speaker.
Thank you.